Now, the current mantra, as I understand it, is that addiction is an illness. But are drugs and alcohol dependency really diseases, well, like Alzheimer's, arthritis? And if not, how not? In particular, what role does choice play in addiction? Now, Jean Hayman is a research psychologist at McLean University and McLean Hospital and a lecturer at Harvard. I just noted that McLean is a very famous psychiatric institution, and its distinguished alumni of patients have included Sylvia Plath, Ray Charles, James Taylor, and the poet Robert Lowell. I'd just like to toss that in before I introduce the guest. Anyway, he's written a provocative new book, Addiction, A Disorder of Choice, which suggests that addicts have much more in common with dieters than they do with cancer sufferers. Jean's analysis has clear ramifications for the treatment and prevention of addiction, but also for understanding the way choice operates in all our lives. And he joins me now from his home in Boston, and the name Boston reminds me that I have chosen to be addicted to English breakfast tea. Jean, welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you very much for that very nice introduction.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse, America's primary research body on dependency, describes addiction as a chronic and relapsing brain disease. Now, that's the most influential view. Take it apart for me, Jane.
Exactly. NIDA, or National Institute of Drug Abuse, frequently refers to addiction as a disease, as do most of my colleagues. Where I differ from them is probably in how I frame the issue to begin with. It's common to frame addiction as a question of biology versus experience or versus environment, and of course addiction does have biological roots, but I think it is more useful to frame it as an issue of the degree to which drug use in people who meet the criteria for addiction is susceptible to the influence of costs, benefits, the opinions of others, concern about legal ramifications, desire for respect from family.
Now, I see where you're taking this, because illnesses are involuntary, but drug use, even for addicts, is still, to some degree, voluntary behavior.
Actually, yes, and when I looked at the data, what I really did was look at data that's available to everyone. This isn't anything new, but I looked at what was out there in the literature, largely because of courses I was teaching. And what I discovered quite shocked me, or surprised me. I initially started off wanting to find out how drug use became involuntary. And when I read biographies and epidemiological studies, I saw, one, that most of the people who met the criteria for addiction after about age 30 no longer did so. They had stopped using. And this is something that's in the data. It's been replicated many, many times in national surveys. And then I began to look at why they had quit. And typically they were not in treatment, but it was the factors that influence their everyday life.
Well, you can't do that with Alzheimer's or MS, can you?
Exactly.
The sufferer has no control.
Yeah, and that's the comparison that I draw. I looked at other diseases and even other psychiatric diseases like schizophrenia. And their programs, if we get to the issue of what the implications are for treatment, there are treatment programs that fit my analysis that are based on contingencies. And there are no such contingent-based programs for schizophrenia or OCD or depression.
So you're confronting what's known as the brain-based model of addiction, aren't you? And that's the dominant view on drug and alcohol. And that's promoted at the major rehab institutions.
Well, I'm confronting, I think, the disease-based interpretation, because where disease is anything that's biological. I think that the brain is the organ of choice. We use our brains when we make choices. And
yes, forgive my hiccup. I got that wrong, but I know exactly what you're arguing.
Yeah. I'm saying that the people at NIDA have actually framed the issue incorrectly, that they should look at it in terms of the kinds of factors that influence drug use in addicts. And when we do that, we see that they're very different than the factors that influence the symptoms of schizophrenia, or Alzheimer's disease or heart disease and so on. And these are diseases that people claim addiction is like. And they say that because, there is a genetic susceptibility, but there's a big difference between genetic susceptibility and voluntariness.
Drug use does change the brain, though, doesn't it?
Exactly. And that's why we use it. We like to get intoxicated, and intoxication of different areas of the brain turn off and others turn on. And some of these changes are residual, that they persist. And so I ask the same question, though. I say, do the changes that are induced by drug use prevent someone from being influenced by the consequences of their behavior? And that's, in a sense, a behavioral question. We have to look at the data. Do people who are long-time drug users no longer respond to costs and benefits of the drug use? And if anything, we see that the longer people use drugs, the more likely they are to quit. Which is just the opposite relation that we see with these other disorders, that the longer they last, the harder they are for people to be treated or cured.
My guest is Gene Heyman. His book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. And this is a little wireless program called LNL on ABC Radio National, etc. I want to go back to one of the issues that confuses the layperson, certainly this layperson, and that is the whole question of genetic makeup. Is there, in your view, a gene for addiction?
Well, there are. What we know most about is alcoholism. It's much easier to study heredity for a legal drug than an illegal one, and there are many more alcoholics than other drug addicts. And we see that there are several, not just one, but several genetic pathways that influence the susceptibility to alcoholism. Some actually decrease it, such as Asians. There are a large number, proportion of Asians, especially Chinese, when they metabolize alcohol, they produce something called acetaldehyde, which is toxic, so they get sick and basically don't drink. There seem to be other genetic mechanisms that increase the tolerance for alcohol, and that seems to be associated with higher drinking rates for people who can tolerate alcohol more are more likely to become alcoholic.
Is there any knowledge about the genetic predisposition amongst indigenous people? Because in your country and mine, it's indigenous people who seem most devastated by alcohol.
Well, that is surprising. It's given that for American Native peoples are people believe migrated from Asia. What is surprising is that they don't seem to have the protection that Chinese, the genetic protection of other Asians. It's really kind of a confused topic. We see big differences depending on where Native people live. Those who live on what we call reservations have much higher alcoholism rates than those who do not. And so it seems, in at least from a lot of the data, that it has a lot to do with their living conditions. But I think it's still an open topic.
What about the physical trauma of withdrawal from drugs like heroin, the chills, the aches, the spasms? Doesn't that take drug use out of the realm of choice?
Great point. Withdrawal symptoms are part and parcel, not of all addictions. Certainly there aren't the somatic symptoms with cocaine, but certainly with heroin and also with alcohol, and to some extent with smoking. What's different about withdrawal syndrome and, let's say, many other illnesses is that people know that withdrawal from heroin, it lasts typically about a week. It is like getting the flu. I think it's very hard to say how difficult it is for people, to put yourself in their shoes when it comes to something so unpleasant. On the other hand, it's something that millions of people have gone through and sometimes go through voluntarily when they want to, in a sense, lower the price of their drug use by removing. If you go through withdrawal, you become less tolerant, and so you can use smaller doses. So it's something that, yes, it is painful, very unpleasant, like getting a bad case of the flu, but it's something that is not lethal, and you're trading, 1 week of great discomfort for a lifetime without drugs. So it's a trade-off that most people, most heroin addicts end up making.
You argue that our perception of drugs is somewhat skewed by the kind of people who become long-term addicts, particularly the famous ones, and end up in treatment clinics. But yes, they're not typical drug users, are they?
Right, great point. It turns out that what we know about addiction is typically based on clinic populations. Those who show up in the clinic, it's much easier to study them. But what we have discovered is that most individuals who meet the criteria for addiction do not go to treatment. And so the treatment populations are quite different. And then we can ask, well, how are they different? Well, they typically have other medical disorders, psychiatric and non-psychiatric disorders. And so there's a very strong correlation between the persistence of drug use, behind what I'm saying, is that the addicts who are in treatment actually have much higher relapse rates than those not in treatment and are much less likely to remit. And that is correlated with the presence of additional psychiatric and other medical disorders.
There's another line here which I'd like to raise. It just suddenly occurs to me. Over the years, I've known a few people who have been lifetime users of heroin. They've been musicians, artists, very skilled people. They've never been addicts. They've used it strategically, tactically. And I wonder why, if drugs are held to be so addictive, more people aren't addicts.
Well, they're what we call chippers. And in fact, most people that we know are alcohol chippers. That is, alcohol is addictive, but most people are social drinkers. And yes, there are these interesting cases of heroin chippers, cigarette chippers, cocaine chippers, who use typically just when they're not musicians, at least, use on the weekend. And what is interesting, one of the interesting things about them is that they arrange social relations that reinforce not going overboard. And they look down on people who splurge on drugs, and they take just a certain amount, which they ration out for, let's say, a Friday night, and they don't use any more. So yes, addiction is or drug use in general reflects not just pharmacology, but individual differences in the social institutions that surround it. So it is a multifactorial phenomena, and we just can't look at it in terms of pharmacology, which is not to say that pharmacology is unimportant.
Gene, you talk about the conundrum of voluntary behavior being self-destructive, and that this blindsides a lot of researchers.
Yes. We have an interesting tradition, into a cultural tradition about voluntary behavior. On the one hand, there's fields such as economics that assumes that people make the optimal choice. On the other hand, we know from literature that people are persistently self-destructive. If that weren't the case, we wouldn't have all these new memoirs and plays and so on. And so people have a hard time figuring out whether or not we're rational creatures or irrational creatures. And I make the argument that we have rationalities that apply in ever increasing or decreasing domains. You can do what's the best thing to do at the moment, but what the best thing to do at the moment may not be the best thing to do for the day or the month the year. And so that we have these converging, we have these sort of, as it were, circles or expanding circles under which we make choices. And a choice, the best choice right now is quite likely may not be the best choice a year from now.
And you make the point that undesirable outcomes are achieved incrementally.
Yes. So the example I think that's easiest to make is someone who smokes cigarettes. They're not smoking in order to get cancer. They're smoking in order to make the next 5 minutes more pleasant. That is, if you say, well, what's the best way to spend the next 10 minutes? And if you're a smoker, well, it's to have a cigarette, especially if you haven't smoked for an hour. And then if you ask the same person, do you want to be a lifetime smoker with a risk of smoking-related disease of 50% or more, they would say, of course not. But when they're smoking, they're not making that decision. They're just having one more cigarette. And for everybody who's tried to go on a diet, you know that you're going to go on a diet tomorrow. And if you could choose, instead of if you could choose for the year to be on a diet and press some button and it would push you on a diet for a whole year, you would probably do that. But you have to do it one step at a time, and that's what makes it so hard.
Ellen Nell, ABC Radio National, Gene Heyman, research psychologist at McLean Hospital, lecturer at Harvard. The new book, Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. One of the most compelling arguments you make, I think, involves the behaviour of Vietnam soldiers and the flood of heroin use, which then, in fact, didn't turn them into lifetime addicts.
Right. That's a very interesting episode. There's a call coming in. I don't know if you hear the beeps. It raises the question of what happens when people who are really probably like a normal population, they're guys who were drafted, they pass physicals, they pass psychiatric tests. What happens when they take heroin? What was discovered is that although they were using very high-grade heroin in Vietnam so anywhere from several months to a year or more, when they came back to the United States, 88% of them basically stopped using. And many of these guys, when they were leaving Vietnam, tested positive, and they tested even though they knew that would delay their return home. So they were what people might call compulsive users. They were using despite the negative consequences staying in Vietnam more. But when they got back, they typically stopped using, 88%, even though they could have gotten, many of them, half of them actually tried using heroin again, but just tried it and then stopped using. So it's an interesting kind of natural experiment about what happens when you take a bunch of people and you give them heroin and then they go back to their everyday life. And again, drug use is something which is just not pharmacology, but it depends on what the alternatives are, what the context is.
I take your point that drug testing to keep a job or to keep a place in a sporting team is a huge disincentive, drug courts, social disapproval. But I wonder whether 12-step programs like AA work, and if so, why?
Well, that's interesting. I think AA is a really incredibly interesting organization. It's a really grassroots organization. It spontaneously emerged. I think it reflects a lot about the nature of alcoholism. I make a distinction between what AA says and what they actually do. What AA does is it provides a social life for people that doesn't include alcohol, and one of the fears of heavy drinkers is that drinking is so tied with their social life that if they give up drinking, they'll be giving up a social life. They'll be alone. Well, AA provides a social environment without alcohol. It also, I think, provides hope for people because they meet people, others like themselves, who have successfully stopped drinking. And it also offers roles for people where they can be socially successful, again, without alcohol, like the mentoring role. So I think it does exactly what a choice model says it should do. It provides alternatives, non-drug alternatives, and it provides people with hope. It's very at the beginning of quitting, you're going through a very rough period, and it gives people hope, and it also gives them success in their mentoring relationships and sponsoring relationships of other AA members.
Gene, I've always been intrigued by the way AA users insist on using the term recovering addict, not recovered addict,
right?
Regardless of how long the person last used the drug of choice.
Yes, that is interesting, and I think they're really on to something. I think that there are people for whom this is one of their claims is that you're always one drink away from a drunk. That there are people who, once they start drinking, it's very hard to stop. There's a phenomenon, this kind of cognitive narrowing that occurs with alcohol and other drugs. That's what part of intoxication. And so I think that there are people who it's much easier for them to live a life under control if they don't drink at all. I think there are many people who are serious problem drinkers who can become social drinkers, but there are those who that becomes problematic. And I think AA addresses that issue.
It occurs to me that framing addiction as a disease might work against people quitting because it deepens a sense of helplessness.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that, and there really aren't data about that particular issue. I've wondered, you know, does telling someone you have a chronic relapsing disease interfere with their getting better? It turns out, since most people actually quit at age 40, 76 to 80% of those who've ever met the criteria for addiction no longer do so, and most have done so since age 30, it doesn't stop them. However, it may perhaps slow them down. But that's something that is has not been researched, and it hasn't been researched partly because the fact that most people quit is not really well known, although it's in the data.
I like the way you argue that there's a deep-seated tendency to consume too much of whatever we like best.
Yeah.
And that as we get wealthier, we tend to do that. Hence, everything now is deemed to be addictive: shopping, surfing
right.
the internet, sex, etc.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but yes, you're absolutely right. It turns out that if we look at this model of choice that I use, it turns out that we always take a little bit too much of what we like best, no matter what it is, and I think that's behind the dictum of most moral codes, is that moderation is the best policy. That's what the Greeks told us thousands of years ago. And what that, I think they're capturing when they say that, is that very fact, is that even if you don't quite know what is the optimal distribution of choices, if you just take a little bit less of what you like best, you'll end up being better off. And that and this issue, as you point out nicely, becomes more problematic the wealthier we get, the more resources we have to spend on what we like best.
And Gene, are you being burnt in effigy around Harvard and
McLean
Hospital?
Not really. I've been very surprised at the response to the book. Not to be too self-serving, but the most negative responses have come from people who haven't read it. I got a barrage of negative newspaper articles from people from before the book came out, just based on its title. I've gotten a sympathetic response, or the most common response from people who are disease people is that they just ignore it. I mean, and one of the things that happens in science, unfortunately, is that if there's an argument that goes against what you believe, you just ignore it. So that so far has been largely a story, but it's gotten actually good responses from a wide variety of people.
Well, thanks for coming on, Gene. Gene Hayman.
Well, this has been a real pleasure.
Research psychologist at McLean Hospital, lecturer at Harvard. The book Addiction, A Disorder of Choice, is published by Harvard University Press. And this is a little wireless program called, Late Night Live. A bit of music, and then we're going to see if we can save gorillas from humans and humans from gorillas.